If you want to mute your mic, or we can do it from our end, too.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to the Reptile Living Room, featuring John Taylor of Herp House Magazine and James Tintle with Cold Blooded Publishing. The Reptile Living Room is brought to you by Herp House Magazine, the premier digital magazine for the reptile hobbyist, and by Cold Blooded Publishing, your exclusive reptile media publishing company. Now, here are John and James in the Reptile Living Room.
Good evening. Welcome to another broadcast of the Reptile Living Room. We're the only independently produced and distributed live reptile broadcast available today. Each week, we bring you a specific panel of herpetoculture and herpetological respondents to discuss the various aspects of our community and current events impacting and affecting herpetoculture and herpetology. Reptile Living Room also brings modern-day technology to our community through an interactive platform. Interact with our hosts, guests, and other like-minded individuals on the Reptile Living Room YouTube channel live during the show. And I'm your host, John F. Taylor of the Reptile Apartment Group, and we'd like to introduce my co-host over there, James Tintle of Tremendous Tricolors. How are you doing tonight, James?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
Doing well. Thank you, sir. Was raining quite a bit over here earlier today. I think I caught some of your Florida weather up here.
Well, good for you, because it hasn't rained here in weeks. I think I'm in the desert southwest down here, 98 degrees. The only thing that's different is it's humid. Hasn't rained, but it's still humid. So I think Chad's recouping. So poor Chad tonight. I wasn't able to get on the show. Chad, we thank you very much for helping us out.
Yeah, good shout out to Chad. Hope you're doing all right, man.
Hey, John, are you hiding behind your logo there or your avatar?
Oh, see, my camera, the actual symbol said it was off, but I was actually looking at myself on the screen, so I was like, okay, it must be working because no one said anything yet. Sorry about that, folks. Hi.
That's all right. So what do we got tonight, John? We got any shout-outs we want to do tonight?
I would actually like to make a shout-out to the Ontario – oh, my gosh, I'm going to screw up this name. Eastern Ontario News Network, Tammy Wilson, a good friend of ours out there. We're going to be looking into doing some work together very soon. So big shout out to those folks. And then we also have the Eastern Ontario Pet Network, actually is what Tammy works with, but that is part of the Eastern Ontario News Network. It's like one of their channels, I believe, is how it works. And I met Tammy through the Ottawa Area Reptile Club, and Ben Corkum, who is actually one of our sponsors, is the Dragon Lair in Canada up here. If you guys are looking for any reptile supplies at all in Canada, do drop by the Dragon's Lair. It's right there in the showcase, and I'll let Jimmy explain the showcase because I always mess it up.
All right. So let's pound right through our advertisers, get those out of the way so we can bring you a great show. As John said, Dragon Lair's in the showcase. If you look to this side or that side and you're following us on G+, you'll be able to scroll down and see all our advertisers. Please click them, check them out, say hi, and purchase their products. So let's go through the first one. We got Herp House Magazine, your 99% all digital. No. 100% all digital, 99% ad-free magazine. Check them out at herphousemag.com. Then we have Happy Gecko Sticky Situation, Rachel Winchin. Great folks over there. She actually has, I saw come across my news feed, she actually printed out a 27-inch day gecko
with glasses and a pencil.
So I think she's asking people to nominate teachers to get this sticker. Am I correct on that, John?
Yep, that's what I read too, was she was basically looking for nominations of a cool teacher that's into reptiles, and she wants to donate the sticker to them. So
if you know a great teacher that's into reptiles, go ahead and contact Rachel Winchin over at Happy Gecko Sticky Situation, and her website is reptilestickers.com, so check them out. Another great artist that we have on our sponsor list is Natalie Bieto. She does this daily creature and is amazing, some of these drawings and prints and stickers that she does. So make sure you check out Natalyn Bieto, wildlife illustrator. Her new website is reptilearts.com. So check her out and purchase some of those stickers. She's also got handbags and some other goodies over there too. So
she's got all kinds of cool stuff over there. She's always coming up with new designs and just all kinds of killer stuff all the time. I mean, magnets and stickers and full-on prints and just, yeah.
Absolutely.
You guys spend a lot of time over there, trust me.
And especially at her Etsy store, too. Yeah. Check that out. So if you're a reptile breeder and you need shipping supplies or want to find a good shipper, make sure you check out reptilesexpress.com. We use them. I use them through Tremendous Tricolor. Been using them for years. Great people over there. Make sure you tell Debbie when you set up your account that Reptile Living Room sent you that way. Check out reptilesexpress.com, your shipping provider for animals and products as well. Next one, Digital Aquatics. The Herp Keeper is one of your control units. Go ahead and check them out, Digital Aquatics. And then, of course, John mentioned the Dragon Lair, and you can check those out as too. And I'm missing one. Oh, yeah. The Tempo. Temperature recording device. You guys got to check it out. And visit reptileapartment.com because I put out my review of the Tempo out there. So go to reptileapartment.com. I think it's the leading one. It's sticky on the front page. If not, just search it. It'll come up, and you have my total review on the Tempo. So check it out. Great unit. I've been using it all summer long in my incubator, recording all the measurements for temperature, humidity, barometric pressure. Check out the review, and then check out Tempo made by Blue Maestro. I think that wraps up all our sponsors, John.
I think so. I think.
Boy, if that list gets any longer, we're going to have to extend the show.
I'm telling you. Oh, man. So, yeah, our guest tonight is none other than Ethan Kochak, author of... Whoops. I need trying to unmute Ethan's microphone.
You can't. Ethan, you'll have to unmute your mic.
Oh, okay.
There we go.
There it is. Okay. Now we got it. So Ethan is the sole proprietor, artist, and chief cook and bottle washer for the Black Mud Puppy comic book line, which has been around for quite a few years that I know of, extending back, I think, the earliest one I saw was 2009 or somewhere around there.
It exists. The comic itself started in 2000. What you see now started in 2012, but it had existed prior to that, sort of bubbling up to the surface on various social media and stuff like that. So,
okay,
yeah.
All right. So now, why the Black Mud Puppy? I mean, where did that come from?
It came from a axolotl that I owned in about 6th grade. It was the first one that I ever had. It was a melanistic black axolotl, and somehow that transmuted in my head into being a superhero.
Awesome.
So yeah. And also the origin story of the comic started around then too, because it was from Peter Scott wrote a book on axolotls that has, I've still seen it in around, and the opening page of it has the story of the Aztec god Xolotl, which inspired the origin story for the character. So,
all right, that makes sense now. So, what was the attraction to the axolotl in the first place? I mean, why pick an axolotl over, you know, say a dog or a cat?
They're so weird. They're so weird looking, and they're so interesting, and I feel like more people should be forced to enjoy them.
I love how you say that, forced to enjoy them. You will enjoy the axolotl.
Yeah. That is my hope, is to bring appreciation of neotenic salamanders to the world.
Yeah, now let's talk about the neotenic part, because you just blew my mind like 5 minutes before we went live with something that just... We'll get to that in a second, but the neotenic properties, in layman's terms, if you could explain what it means to have neotenic properties in an amphibian or any type of creature.
It means that you retain juvenile characteristics into adulthood while still being able to reproduce. So in the case of axolotls and other salamanders, piranha branch salamanders, they have gills. They basically stay tadpoles into adulthood and reproduce that way.
Wow.
And they're studied because of that. They have extremely good regeneration property. So they're studied for that ability to regenerate, and it's because of their weird nature.
Their weird superpowers?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
His superpowers aren't really that useful. I mean, right now he has the ability to shoot slime and turn his legs backwards. So that's
yeah, he doesn't really have that many superpowers. Is he going to continually evolve throughout the comic?
Or? Yeah, we're getting there. The next story is going to have a little bit more Aztec mythology worked in. And
oh, okay.
The backwards legs thing is a nod of the head to Aztec mythology, because the actual god Xolotl, which is where we get the word axolotl, right?
Right.
Actually had backwards facing feet.
Really? Okay. So there's more than just, you know, you're not just throwing, you know, stuff together out of, you know.
Sometimes I am, but
sometimes I am, sometimes I'm not. You know, it just depends on the mood.
Yes. Yeah. It's up to the reader to break that down. Yeah.
Okay.
I just wanted to mention the Black Mud Puppy website is actually in the showcase. So if there's anybody watching, you can go ahead and click and look at the cartoon that we're actually talking about. So go ahead, click it, the Black Mud Puppy. It's over there in the showcase if you're viewing us on G+. If you're viewing us on YouTube, you don't get to see it. You'll just have to punch it in.
Yeah, the Black Mud Puppy. Gosh, I'm trying to think of something that I could compare it to. And, you know, because most comic book readers, they have certain genres that they stick with, you know, like, you know, superhero and, you know, a specific artist and a specific, you know, even a specific universe sometimes.
Sure.
So where would you classify the Black Mud Puppy universe, as it were?
I would say you're a fan of things like The Tick or Sam and Max, you would probably like Black Mud Puppy. Sort of offbeat, cartoony, weird, indie type comics. If you're into graphic novels and stuff, I'd say the biggest influence graphic novel wise, I always really liked Scud the Disposable Assassin. I always thought that was a really funny comic, and I think a lot of his posing and stuff was kind of inspired by that. And also artwork wise, like, I've always really liked the graphic novelist Doug Tenaple, who created Earthworm Jim and all that stuff. So there's a lot of that kind of inspiration in there, you know.
For sure, I definitely see the Earthworm Jim influence. Now that you've mentioned it, I can actually see some of it. I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, I can. All right.
Yeah, his stuff is really good. But yeah, I would say, you know, probably the thing that the biggest number of people would be most familiar with is sort of The Tick. It's sort of that kind of weird, funny sort of thing.
Yeah, you know, and I don't want to insult anybody, but it is kind of a highbrow comic. I mean, it's like you actually have to understand, you know, more than an average reader would, you know, have to understand, in my opinion. You know, it's not really scientific, but there's a lot of scientific aspects that are, in my eyes, a nod to the science realm.
You got to keep up, I guess. You know, it's I don't like talking down to people, even in, you know, in the comic. I like to, I always go for the joke that I think is funny, and even if it if it's, you know, obviously you don't want to sit there and explain the joke. That doesn't work. But
right.
You know. But you know, I mean, I try to work in stuff that I think is interesting and cool. So, you know, there's jokes about. I mean, there are, yeah, there's definitely jokes that you would not get if you aren't a reptile person or you're not into.
Right.
I guess most recently I made a joke about giant salamanders. So he calls. There's a giant. There's a rampaging giant salamander, Godzilla sized, and he calls it Andreas the Giant.
Nice. So. Very cool. And now, as far as the Neotenic properties, going back to that,
yeah,
the thing that blew my mind was you said you had a leucistic pair of glowing salamanders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Axolotls, rather, sorry.
So, yeah, so you can, one of the more recently sort of established things with axolotls is the availability of animals that are what are called GFP. I've seen people refer to it as glowing fluorescent protein or green fluorescent protein, and they glow under black light. And they were genetically engineered in a lab in order to do that because they were studying things like limb regeneration, and I guess that helped the glowing help them track the way that the nerves were regrowing back and stuff like that. But yeah, they glow in the dark.
That's so bizarre.
And it literally is a GMO pet. It's
yeah, I don't know if that's really cool or just really disturbing. It's I'm not so sure about how I feel about that. That's just really odd.
I'm disturbed. Went from modifying food to modifying our pets genetically. I'm pretty disturbed.
It's kind of the logical conclusion of that, you know what I mean?
next thing you know, we're going to be modifying our brothers and sisters and siblings.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know anybody who's not wanted to do that already. I think modifying our family members would help a lot of people out, let me tell you.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
Now, speaking of family, you just had a recent addition. In the family. Have you found, you know, so how do you find the time to still do the Black Mud Puppy with
as a father of a young child? I usually work at night. I don't get much work done when he's up, so he does like to draw with me. He'll sit there with me and draw on the Wacom tablet with me, and but no, it's mostly done at night. When I have the free time to do it, and it's usually about 90 minutes or so, I'll spend at a time, a couple nights, usually 3 or 4 nights a week.
Man, and just reading on blackmudpuppy.com, the pet sitter, man, that stuff's hilarious. And how long does it take you to come up with, like, for a single story arc like you would read on blackmudpuppy.com right now?
Well, I should see right now what you're seeing there is I just had a guest week, so I had some friends come in and do a series of one-shot pages with me, and that's by an artist named Jennifer Canby, but her website's Jennifer Tanner, and she did that one, and I have some great stuff on there this week. But the a single shot like that doesn't take very long because it's you know, it's usually like 3 panels for me, so I can usually get those done fairly quickly. And what I'm hoping to do kind of coming up is do a whole series. I'll try to get as many of those out there as I can and work on the longer stories while those are running.
Gotcha. Now, you've actually printed at least 2 copies of Black Mud Puppy, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
Yeah. There's two volumes. There's volume one is things you can read on the internet for free, and volume two is the Dead Trees edition.
Nice.
And volume three is probably going to be called, at this point, is going to be called Hell is Other People. There's a character called Hell in the comic, if you're not familiar with it. So, yeah. So, yeah, I actually, this is volume one. That's what volume one is.
Oh, very cool. Dang, that's a big book, too.
Yeah, it's a trade. It's a full trade paperback size.
And oh, my gosh.
I think we ended up doing like 100-something pages.
Yeah. Wow. So now, okay, for those unfamiliar with Black Mud Puppy, could you run us through a quick casting call of the characters that we would see in Black Mud Puppy?
So there's Xolotl, who is the main character. He is the Black Mud Puppy. He's the Aztec god of fire and deformity. And in real mythology, that's where we kind of derived the word axolotl from. So that was the inspiration. He is banished into a salamander for cruelty to goats for 500 years, and then forced to perform good deeds in order to gain back his godhood. That's sort of the central premise of the book. And he has a sidekick / emotional punching bag named Simon. Who's sort of he's a human character. He meets him in the pet store. so he's kind of the herper. he's sort of the me in it. He fights villains like he fights Hitlersaurus, and he sort of fought his ex-girlfriend recently. So she was originally the Norse goddess Hel, who is their underworld god, and she turns into Siren. So the last issue, everyone was a salamander-themed villain. So we had Siren, we had a Hellbender, we had Anides, the tree salamander, who has two heads. So
awesome.
No, I gotta
get two-headed salamander.
I got a question, Ethan. Are you going to stick with the amphibian salamander stuff throughout the whole story pretty much, or are you going to bring in some nasty scaled reptiles too?
I would love to work in more reptile stuff. I don't have anything written along those lines yet, but I have some ideas for some stuff. I would really love to work in a parthenogenic gecko. I used to have mourning geckos, and I thought they were the coolest things. The all female, no male. You know, I was thinking I could work the sort of, you know, Virgin Mary kind of gecko angle with that. So
it would be very interesting.
I have no. I'm not strictly amphibian. That's just the way it's worked out so far.
Very cool. Now, so as far as looking forward into the next few issues for Black Mud Puppy, what do we have coming up that you can talk about?
Sure. The story that I'm working on right now is called Mexican Standoff, and it is about the return of a lot of the other Aztec deities. So Xolotl is going to meet up with some other characters that are in that pantheon of gods and end up in their underworld, which is called Mictlan. And I have some other ideas I'd love to do an alien invasion story, so I have some notes on that, and I think all the aliens are actually going to resemble axolotls in big sort of hydraulic steampunk suits. So
sweet. Steampunk salamanders, I dig it.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh man, this is wild. Went from glowing salamanders to, you know, web comics. I mean, what's next? Are you doing any of the Comic Cons? I mean, where would people find your work other than on the blackmudpuppy.com?
So I've I did do Pittsburgh Comic Con last year with a friend of mine, and I was and I would like to do some more of that. So hopefully we'll be doing more. It would have to be probably in the Northeast for right now, because that's where I am. But yeah, I have done a few little local comic shows in upstate New York and around there, and I do sell stuff through the Black Mud Puppy website also.
Very cool.
Is there any place that actually carries your book, or are you just in-house? Is there any other people, you know, carrying the Black Mud Puppy book, or?
For the most part, it's in-house. I do sell through my local shop, which is called Larger Than Life Comics, Larger Than Life Toys and Comics, and he carries my stuff. He's a great shop too. So, just that one, in Syracuse. But aside from the in-house stuff,
well, that's where it needs to all start, right? You start with one, and you work your way up.
Yeah.
So, I'm like blown away at the whole website and reading through all these Hitlerosaurus, and what really got me was Chumbles the Chihuahua.
Oh yeah, he's Chumbles is quite is Chumbles and Hitlerosaurus are probably the two most popular bits of the like Hitlerosaurus gets a laugh, and I have stickers and stuff that I sell at shows of Hitlerosaurus, so he's kind of the most requested character. And Chumbles is a Chihuahua with no eyes, and he kind of gets a constant string of woes befalls him in the comics. And that's the other one of his Black Mud Puppies. One of his other powers is the ability to duplicate Chihuahuas. So.
Oh wow.
Now, to get out of the underworld with that, actually.
Now, Ethan, what kind of age group is this basically for? I mean, is it a wide range? Are you writing it for a specific age group?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it an all-ages comic because it's a little... I would say it's, if you were going to put a rating on it, it's probably PG-13-ish. It's sort of aimed at me if I was still 13. Yeah, sort of, and like John was saying, because it's a little bit, there's some stuff that I think would kind of sail over younger kids' heads too much.
So you know, at least teenage and up into the 20s and even higher. So
yeah.
Only reason I'm asking is because I have a 12-year-old, so I'm like, might be something she might be interested in. I have to pick up a copy and throw it her way.
Yeah, I say that's kind of what the aim is that sort of age range. Yeah.
Great.
There's nothing like, you know, outright terrible in it or anything. So.
Yeah, and I just want our audience to know that Ethan creates everything. He draws everything. He's a one-man band. I mean, he does everything. It's not like he has a writer write the story for him. He writes all the story. He creates all the artwork. He puts everything together. So make sure you check it out. Support Ethan. I mean, I definitely going to be reading a whole heck of a lot more now.
Yeah, it's really wild. I mean, and this all started just from a childhood pet that you were inspired by.
Yes, yeah.
And how did it come about that you just got into the comic book version of it rather than, say, writing a novel or, you know?
Sure. My background was as an artist. I went to school for animation, but I kind of got out and decided that I didn't really like animating and spent a lot of years just sort of doing odd job, freelance illustration, stuff like that. After my son was born, I kind of decided I wanted to do something that was sort of, you know, for posterity. So so I sat down and I said, well, this is a character that I've had for ages and really want to make. And so I sat down and started making comics. But yeah, there were about 10 years of not doing it the way that I'm doing it now.
Yeah.
Sort of, you know. yeah, you know, writing stuff and doodling stuff, but never formally putting it all together, you know?
Okay.
I think that's the hardest part about comics is that a lot of people, they don't put anything out there because they're too afraid of not finishing it perfectly. They don't want to show anybody else what they've done, so they just don't, you know, they don't do it. They don't put it out. And I did that for years, and then I said, you know what, I'm going to do it anyway.
And what kind of response did you originally get when you, you know, first threw it out there? You know, was it what you expected, or was it not what you expected? How did that work out for you?
It's, I think, like launching anything, it takes a while to find its audience.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I first started, yeah, no, I didn't really have a lot of readership. I have a pretty good, you know, core set of people who I know are looking at it now. But I'd say it took about at least a year before I had, you know, regular feedback when I would post something, you know, get comments and things. Yeah, for a while it does, you know, when you first start, it does feel like you're just kind of throwing it out into the abyss and hoping for the best.
Yeah, like your message in a bottle kind of almost.
Yeah.
Well, isn't that with any startup, you know, creative business too, though? I mean, you, any author, you know, you kind of in the realm of even like novelists and writing a novel or something like that, you know, it takes a while to get your readership up. But once your readership up, then it starts to word of mouth. And, you know, if it wasn't for John, I wouldn't have ever even probably ran across this. So it's something incredible to me. Being in the publishing side of things too, is I'm like, wow, this is, you know, this is something new to an area of herpetoculture that really can flourish and people can actually learn from your comics as well.
I think there's a lot in herpetology and science that can inspire art and popular culture, and I think that's a big part of what it is.
Now, as far as the other comics that you've done, I was just browsing through, you know, and I remembered the a series of stuff you had done with Tetsu.
Yep.
Tetrapod zoology and stuff like that. How did that come about? And, you know, because it goes more outside of the realm of herpetoculture, but still...
That's a much more hardline science thing.
Yeah. But it also stays within the animal realm, too.
Yeah.
You know, so you're not actually, you know, moving off into a total new universe. How did that come to be, and how did that work out for you?
So I had been reading Darren's blog, which is Tetrapod Zoology, for quite a while. I think probably I started reading his blog in 2006-ish, 2006-2007, and it's a great... Tetrapod Zoology is an awesome blog. It's really good. He's at Scientific American now. He used to be on science blogs when I started. And so he writes about all anything having to do with tetrapods. So that's basically the vertebrates that aren't fish, you know, all of us four-legged critters.
Yeah.
And he does it in a really interesting way that doesn't talk. I mean, that's kind of a theme with me, is I really don't like things that talk down to people.
Yeah.
And it's done in a way that kind of is very, you know, I mean, it can be hard to follow it, but it, because if you're not, I mean, I've learned a ton of science by trying to follow along with that stuff. I'm not in any way a science, you know, academic or anything. So it started with me being a regular reader and sort of lurker there, and then right around the time that I got more involved with Twitter, I started talking to Darren on Twitter quite a bit, back and forth. Mm-hmm. And you know, so I had done some, you know, he did a Tetsu article on salamanders of the world. And he put the black mud puppy on there as a joke, kind of. So it kind of started from that, and I came to him and said, you know, I had this idea to take some of your blogs and turn them into cartoons, and you know, I wanted to know what you thought. And so we did that, and I showed it to him, and he thought it was pretty good. And so we kind of went with that. And the Tetsu comic is basically just a Tumblr account that I periodically will post comics on. And I have to finish the Rhino comic. It's almost done. White Rhino comic part 3 that's going to go up fairly soon.
Awesome.
And so, you know, so that one I don't, it's not like Black Mud Puppy where I like regimentedly post things 3 times a week. It's more of when I have free time, ha ha ha, that I do that one. But it's actually gotten a huge response. It's gotten a really, really good response. And I think the reason for that is because, you know, when you do a webcomic, you tend to market that to other people who are webcomic people. And in the case of the Tetsu stuff, it's the audience was all sort of people who are scientists, you know, working scientists. And so it was a totally different audience than what I had been working with before. And I think that's what, you know, and also too, I got to say, you know, to give Darren credit, his blog is so good and he already has such a big audience. It's kind of built in there.
I hear you. So now, as far as moving forward, any new projects that you're looking at as far as expanding on the Black Mud Puppy product line maybe? Or I noticed you got some looks like plush toys, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I do. Here, I'm showing you. I have one. It's right there.
Oh, nice. Yeah. How cool is that?
Yeah, that's the plushie. So I have... Basically, it's been this past year has been kind of more about focusing on trying to build more of an audience. So I spend a lot of time on Twitter talking to people. But also, I do have plans to kind of put book 3 together fairly soon. Okay. So we'll have another printed book.
All right.
Pretty soon.
Very cool. Now, as far as the website goes, there's a running comic on there constantly. Is that correct?
There's always something.
Yeah, there's always something.
There will always be something. The comic typically updates Monday, Wednesday, Fridays. Like I said, this week's been every day because we were doing guest week.
Right.
So I had a new artist every day doing a guest comic. But typically it's Monday, Wednesday, Friday.
Okay. Very cool. Now, bringing it back out of the comic world, because we know you're one of the, you know, foremost authorities on axolotls as far as we're concerned anyway. talk to us about the Captive Care. I mean, let's,
sure.
You know, starting from, you know, because I've seen people buy the, like, eggs online and then hatch them at home and feeding brine shrimp and... So if you wouldn't mind, take us through the process of, you know.
Interesting. The egg thing is because some places don't, I think it's England. Axolotls are actually really a big deal in England. There's a lot of English keepers and keepers in the UK. And
I've noticed
apparently
that.
With some of their shipping rules, like they're not allowed to ship the live fry, but the eggs are okay. And that's a big part of why people were shipping eggs at each other.
Wow. Okay.
So as far as captive care, you need for a single individual, you need at least a 10. I usually kind of recommend a 20-gallon sort of setup. They don't like a lot of flow, so filters. If you're going to use a hang on the, I mean, a lot of people like to use hang on the back power filters. If you're going to use a hang on the back, you want to find a way to sort of try to break up the flow a little bit.
Okay.
So you can do that with, you know, where the output is. You can put, you know, try to put some plants or something like that. Okay. I've seen people use pieces of slate rock You know, so they'll get like a flower pot and put it on end and put the rock on the top and let the water hit that so it's dispersed a little bit. I use a canister filter. So in our tank, the output from the canister filter, I built a spray bar out of some PVC pipe.
Okay.
And that's found the best way to get kind of nice flow dispersed.
Okay.
And then temperature is their other big thing. They really don't like warm temperature. So you want to try to keep the water as cool as you possibly can. We're talking, you know, ideally mid to high 60s. You know, like in the summer, my tank can get into the 70s. And so I'll have to do things like put a fan by the tank, put some ice bottles in the water to keep the water cool. But you want to try to keep the water as cool as you can.
Wow.
Jeez, I would have to put the tank next to the freezer down here in Florida.
Or you'd have to get a chiller or something, you know? I mean,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think I'll be investing in any axolotls anytime soon. It's going to cost me more to get the chiller and everything else.
Yes.
That's surprising. I didn't know they like such cool water temperatures. So,
well, and you wouldn't think that being from Mexico, but they live in very cold, you know, deeper water, dark, deep. You know, they like their water really cold. And that's actually very common with neotenic salamanders in general. That seems to be part of what sort of causes them to evolve in that direction. They like cold water.
Now in the wild, do they typically live in like muddy, or is it clean but yet non-flowing? What kind of, you know, what type of water are we talking, you know?
Well, axolotls are from, I'm not going to get the pronunciation of the lake right because I have trouble with the Aztec words, but it's with an X. I can't say the name. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. Xochimilco, I think, is how you say it. But it's one. It's essentially one lake that's in Mexico City. That's where they came from.
Okay, so that's it. That's the only lake.
There might have been one or two other little surrounding area lakes,
right,
as well, but that's where they're from. And unfortunately, they're extremely endangered in their actual wild habitat. They found, there was a study last year that had concluded that they may actually be extinct in the wild. But it turns out that they did find one male after that came out.
Right, that's what I had heard. They had found something after that report had come out that...
Yes.
So they weren't actually extinct yet.
Well, what kills me about that is that they're so common in the pet trade, you know, in the world of science and in the world of the pet trade. Like they're an extremely commonly kept animal, but they're almost gone in the wild.
That is pretty mind blowing to think about that, really. That an animal that, you know, has literally disappeared from the wild is common fodder for the pet trade.
Yep.
Now, is there anything on releasing them back into the wild? Any kind of captive breeding programs that could possibly lead to reintroducing the species back into the wild, or is that looked down upon? Or
at this time, no. I actually had a conversation, not about this specifically, but about this idea of reintroduction with a friend of mine who's a conservation biologist on Twitter, and. But you can't do that if you don't fix the problems that caused it in the first place. And we haven't really addressed those problems, I think. In the case of that lake, there's pollution because there's runoff from the city. It's right in the city. A lot of the lake was broken up into canals.
Okay.
And they have another problem with introduced tilapia fish.
Wow, I didn't know about the tilapia there.
I think what I read was that the tilapia are eating their, I guess it's that they're eating their young.
Yeah.
Got it. Well, that,
I did not know about the tilapia at all. That sucks.
Okay. So let's get back into the captive care.
Yep.
So they like cool water, pretty much standing, low flow, cool water. Yes. Any lights? Do they need any UV lights? I mean, considering they're down a little bit deeper, I would imagine lighting wouldn't be an issue with them.
They generally don't mind lighting, but you don't. Since they're kind of a cold, deep water animal, they don't particularly care for being out in full light all the time. So, my main tank in my living room is a planted tank. And so I have LED lighting on there, but there's lots of places for them to hide and get out of the light, and it's not kept on all the time. And, you know, you can do lighting if you want to have live plants, but be aware that, you know, they don't particularly care for bright light. They need spaces to get out of the light. And they also will crawl all over your plants and uproot them all the time. So if you're going to do live plants, that's also a hazard with that.
Well,
street-wise, too, this is a big thing with axolotls, and it's an often debated thing if you are in axolotl communities online. They have a tendency to ingest substrate. So if you want to have plants, then you kind of want to use, you have to use sand or rocks that are way too big for them to eat. If you use gravel, they have a tendency to get impacted. The thing with this is, you know, nobody knew that before the age of the internet. So if you look at like the original, you know, those like the books that are out there, anything that was printed before the internet, there's plenty of stuff on gravel in there. You know, people showing axolotls on pea gravel that now would make people go, oh my God, you can't do that. And I'm not sure how much of that is the internet, you know, echo chamber. I used rocks. I had rocks in my tank, but I don't use anything that was so small that they could ingest it.
Right.
Right.
But, you know, it's funny because this past week we went to our local zoo and they have an axolotl that is enormous and they've had it for at least 10 years and they have theirs on gravel.
Huh.
And, you know, I don't know, you know, I don't think anyone's ever done an actual study on how big of a danger the gravel stuff really is to them.
Right. Now, do you think that's a feeding response because of what's being fed? Like,
they're suctioning
to the bottom, or
it's when they eat something. You know, if you give them, I usually feed them. I do earthworms and I do pellets. You know, sinking pellets, and they will eat by just sucking water in quickly.
Right.
And I think when I have no doubt that there are axolotls that get stones swallowed and they get impacted.
Sure.
No question. But I think it's one of those things where it's the sort of the extent to which how frequently it happens, I think, is like kind of a little bit maybe overstated.
Overabundantly stated, yeah.
Yeah. Because like I said, I've seen them kept on it, and you know, I know that the zoo where I live has done that for many years, and I don't think they've ever had it. I don't know. I don't work for the zoo, but I don't think they have a problem with it. A lot of people just don't do it on the basis of you know, why take the risk, and I think that's true. You know,
for sure.
So sand or no substrate at all is the preferred. Is what most people will recommend for substrate. You can use stones, but if you're going to use stones, they need to be big.
Almost like with the Pyxicephalus, the Pacman frogs, or the pixie frogs, whichever you want to call, you know.
Yep.
You know the genus I'm talking about.
Indiscriminate eater like that, yeah.
Right. The indiscriminate eaters that'll just, you know, they'll swallow anything that they can fit in their mouth.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Now, with the axolotls, how big do those, because I know you said the one at the zoo is enormous, and we talked about starting out with a 10-gallon tank. Is that a lifetime tank, or do we have to move up in size, or...
Excuse me. Their adult male in is probably not much larger than 10 gallons. I don't know if they move it off display, so I couldn't tell you.
Okay.
But it is quite a large animal, and it's probably it's over a foot long.
My gosh. That is huge.
Wow, I didn't know. I didn't realize they got that big. I never ever seen them that big. So that's wild.
Yeah, my wild type GFP that I have is, she's probably 10 inches, I would guess. She's probably like...
God, that's freaking huge.
Yeah. And they don't take, I mean, they can get that size in a year or two. They don't take particularly long to get...
Really?
Yeah.
Now, how big do they have to be for breeding age? And is there any certain... you know, temperature, lighting to induce breeding?
There's not much. I've had axolotls that spontaneously started without a whole lot of prompting. They do tend to start breeding if you change something. So if you change the water temperature, it actually doesn't seem to matter whether you change it up or down.
Good.
A change to their environment in some way.
That's your cue to go for it.
Otherwise, you'll spark that. It doesn't take much. They're not too difficult to breed.
Now, are they? Can you tell males and females by size, by color? How do we tell males and females apart?
So they have slightly different body and head shape, and males definitely have. They'll have a cloacal swelling. So you can definitely tell a mature male from a female. But the heads are shaped a little bit differently. The males sort of have, in my experience, the males will sort of have a narrower face, and the females will usually have kind of a wider head.
Okay.
And female, yeah, a lot of female salamanders, not just axolotls, but a lot of ambystomidid salamanders like axolotls, the females will be bigger. They'll be slightly bigger, and they'll be kind of rounder in, around the middle because you can kind of see where the eggs are building up.
Now, how many eggs does a female typically lay?
It can be a lot. It can be hundreds.
Wow.
Usually... You know, usually, like, a clutch could be, you know, 100 eggs or more. I mean, they could be just, it's like, you know, when you go out in the springtime and you see, you know, frogs and salamanders laying eggs where you are now, you'll see huge clumps of eggs. That's
basically huge swans. That's amazing. Now, are they social animals or?
They're not, they're not particularly social in terms of seeking each other out, but they're also not aggressive or territorial.
Okay.
So you can usually get away with keeping adult axolotls together in a large enough tank. You know, if you're going to do a couple of individuals, you know, the reason that I say 10 or 20 gallons is they don't, as adults, they don't move, they're not particularly active animals once they're adults.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't move around a ton. I still try to give them enough room as if they were going to use it.
Right.
So that, you know, so they're going to probably at best kind of ignore each other. They don't seem to seek out each other's presence, but they also aren't aggressive or territorial towards each other, typically.
Okay.
Little ones, when you're rearing them, will bite each other, like they'll tear each other's limbs off and try to eat each other and
wow.
Worry about it when they're small.
Brutal.
Yeah.
But of course, Darren comes through the whole regeneration thing. So
I was going to say,
whatever, you just ate my arm. Who cares?
May this stronger survive too.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So how long is it? You know, from the female laying the eggs, is it in an egg mass, or are they just kind of free floating? Does she try to lay them by plant material, material?
They will usually try to attach to plants. I keep a lot of anacris and hornwort around in the tank for that, and you can really just pull up. You know, if you're getting started, the best thing you can do is sort of pull about 10 or 20 eggs from the mass and just do your best to raise those, because it's really hard to raise a whole lot of baby axolotls if you haven't done it before.
I'm just trying to think about feeding 20 of those little buggers, you know.
Well, they only
own with the brine shrimp and
yes, they only eat the live. They only eat live when you get started, when they're first hatched out.
Oh hell!
It doesn't take very long. It only takes a couple of, you know, it takes, you know, a week or so. I mean, like they hatch very quickly, but they immediately want live food. They won't eat anything not live. So you're doing brine shrimp and Daphnia and little anything that's
yeah.
Now, how big are they when they hatch, size wise? How small?
Very small, like I guess under. I mean, we're talking like under half an inch long, quarter inch long.
Wow.
Yeah, they're really tiny. Really tiny.
I bet you they're very big eaters at that time to get the size to them.
Yeah.
Now, how long, you know, from that time, from, let's say, the egg mass being laid to actually hatching, what's the typical time frame? I mean, it's cool water, but do they hatch fairly quickly, a week, in 2 weeks?
Yeah, typically it's very quickly like that. The longer stuff is just getting them to the point where they, you know, once they start sprouting legs, about a month or so after they've hatched, you can start feeding them the easier stuff.
Okay.
And things get a lot easier at that point. They stop trying to constantly kill each other.
Cool. It sounds like a really neat species to work with, that's for sure.
Yeah.
No, I mean, they look incredible. I mean, it's something, you know, totally different from any of the regular lizards, salamander. I mean, they just have that specific look for anybody that's never seen them before. They have that specific look. So, not only that, I mean,
It's one of those animals where, you know, I have our two big females in a tank in the living room, and, you know, the most common thing I get with them is people will look at that and they ask if they're real.
Yeah, I guess they have that alien look to them.
Yeah.
Now,
speaking of aliens.
Now, earlier, before the show started, we were talking about ones that have been being injected.
Yeah.
Can we touch on that a little bit? Because I'm kind of interested in seeing how they're doing that.
I've not done that. I have seen a few pictures of it. It's I think similar to the dye injection that they've done on like some of the tetras. Another tropical fish over the years.
Right,
like the glass fish, I think, is what we used to call them.
Yep.
And I know it's a form of tetra. I don't know what exact form it was.
I've seen it with a few different fish, and it's usually some kind of clear glass fish that they've dye-injected. We used to call them painted tetra. I think we just called them painted.
Yeah, the painted tetras. I remember that.
And it's the same idea. They basically take them. They usually take an albino or a leucistic animal that doesn't have any, you know, naturally, you know, it's a non-pigmented animal.
Right.
They'll dye inject them. So I've seen them. You know, they're like bright pink and blue and green. You know, I mean, like they're
purple and yeah.
Yeah.
Now, does that affect, because I've seen, like you said, the pictures, and I've seen a couple, at least I think it was a couple of them, of these ones that were glitter injected.
I don't know.
The gold fleck or something?
They always used to tell us that the dye thing wasn't harmful to the fish, but I gotta tell you, it doesn't seem right to me.
Yeah. And I'm still kind of baffled as to the whole glitter effect that I saw in these two axolotls.
Well, you know, I mean, maybe what you were seeing there is, you know, some of the wild types are naturally, they have like gold flecking.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so people, you know, of course, people being into breeding, doing what they do, have tried to emphasize that even more, and so you've now got animals that are more like that. That I think some of the copper, it might be the copper morph ones, that have like the I mean, like my wild type, one of my wild types definitely has sort of a coppery metal almost look, metallic looking speckles on it.
Right. So. Okay. That very well could have been it.
Now, the most commonly seen morph, I guess, would be the albino, which, you know, is most commonly seen. What other morphs are there and you know, that's being bred?
So, you've got the wild types are gray, and there'll be anywhere from, like, a light gray to a darker, almost black. There's a melanistic, which is jet black, totally black, and if you're trying to, like, a lot of people will ask you, is this a dark wild type or a melanistic? And you can kind of tell by looking at the ridge, the eye, the iris, melanistic animals, it's all black. They're like jet black.
Oh, okay.
And then, you know, leucistic animals are, they're like the light colored with the dark eyes, and then you've got, on top of that, you've got a lot of these guys doing the GFP stuff now, so you can have a GFP wild type, a GFP melanistic, or a GFP albino.
And these all glow under black light. That's just...
Yeah, and so do the eggs.
Oh my gosh, it's so bizarre.
Wow. Yeah. Is there any other morphs? I know you had touched on that. Some are breeding for, you know, higher flecking. Are some breeding for like more of a bronze copper color? Or
yeah, there is actually a morph called copper, and it's sort of a rusty looking. It kind of looks like a rusty wild type. There's more than one kind of albino. So you have gold albinos. You have, which are kind of a yellowish-tinged albino. You've got the, like, straight, normal white albino. So, yeah, and there are also harlequin-type animals. So they'll have, leucistic animals that have flecking, right?
Okay.
You have a leucistic animal that will have sort of freckles on its face. You can have what's called a dirty Lucy, which is a Lucy that has lots of freckles.
Jesus.
Yep. And you can have these harlequin animals that look like, almost like, you know, they're like an albino with black, like, cow spots.
Wow.
A leucistic animal with, like, cow spots. And there are also chimeras, which have essentially two individuals, twins in the egg that fused, so they are half one color and half another.
Now, how common is that? Chimeras,
not common at all. The harlequins and those guys, those are really rare. The last time I looked, the person that I had spoken to about buying one, I'm not going to buy one, but they were like $2,000.
Right.
That was like maybe a year or two ago when I looked into that. And the chimeras, I don't even know. I don't know. But they seem to be more common over in the UK.
Right.
It's interesting. the UK and Australia, there are a lot of keepers of axolotls. Apparently, axolotls are one of the few herps that are legal in Australia to own, as far as salamanders go. So, a lot of keepers there. And some of those morphs, I've never seen the chimera ones in the U.S. There must be some, but I know that they're in the U.K.
Wow. Now, the genetics of it, are they simple recessive? Are they codominant? What's the basis on some of the, take albino. If you bred an albino to a wild type, would you create all wild type babies?
That hasn't been my experience. I'm not particularly up on the genetics side of things. But my experience has been that when I bred the wild type that I had. Now, see, I think what it is, though, is that these guys have been captive bred a lot, and you don't know what you're getting. So even though I was about to say that I had bred a wild type to an albino and I got, 50-50 on that, I think it's more because it was actually a wild type that was holding recessive genes.
Right.
Mm.
That it was a het animal.
Gotcha. Okay.
Understandable. I mean, they've been breeding them by mass numbers for a number of years. So, I mean, when you only have a small gene pool to pull from that eventually were in captivity, eventually everything is going to carry the same gene. You're not going to be able to outsource them anywhere, yes. Especially if they're almost extinct in the wild as well.
The most of the animals that are in captivity are actually descended from, I don't remember the year, but a lot of them came from some of the first ones that were brought over to Europe, and they were brought to the botanical gardens in Paris. Wow. And they were bred there for the first time. Like, that was kind of where that started. But I don't know a whole lot about the story about how that happened, but I know that that's like where they were first bred and they were first kept, and I know that a lot of the strains that were used in labs and stuff, they descended from those animals.
Wild. Now, as far as axolotls and salamanders, axolotls will or can, I guess, eventually evolve, if you will, into a salamander. Is that not accurate? And there's also a lot of controversy as far as getting them to evolve in captivity as well?
Well, axolotls are they're ambystomatid salamanders, so they're closely related to tiger salamanders and spotted salamanders and stuff like that, which are terrestrial salamanders.
Right.
And if you inject them with iodine and give them, was it thyroxine hormone treatment, you can encourage them to actually metamorphose. Just like any other larval salamander would do. It has happened to people in the hobby where they've kept them and they've actually metamorphosed. It may just be that happens sometimes with certain individual animals.
Oh, okay.
I've never seen it happen. but it does happen, and usually the animal doesn't live very long after that happens. Usually they live less than a year.
And that's what some of the controversy is. It's like, if you don't force the metamorphose and let the animal alone, as it were, they do have a very extended lifespan.
Oh, yeah.
In comparison.
Yeah.
And that seems to be one of the major factors that has really gotten under people's skin as far as keeping axolotls, is why would you, shorten the lifespan just to have a salamander? Why not just get another type of salamander?
Right, yeah, buy a tiger salamander or a spotted salamander.
Yeah, it's like, and what are we doing as far as conservation of, the current axolotl population out there in Mexico? Is there anything being done, or have we just pretty much resigned to the fact that they're extinct?
I think right now it's not so much that they've resigned themselves to that fact, it's more to do with that if we were going to start a reintroduction plan, it would really we would have to address the issues that caused it in the first place. And, you know, it's actually kind of what we were just talking about. We say we have wild type axolotls in our in the hobby, but we don't know if that's actually what they are. You know, because you can end up with genetics that don't make sense there. Maybe carrying, you know. So I think we don't want to see people, you know, I don't think anybody wants to see people releasing these genetically modified animals.
Yeah, no GMO animals. That would probably be bad.
Yeah.
Definitely so. Jeez. Well, very informative, Ethan. I appreciate you being on the show. This is a lot more information than I ever thought I would have about axolotls in my lifetime, man.
Thank you.
I just want to keep them now.
I know. I want to go grab a tank and set one up just so I can keep one.
Exactly. I'm like, damn, now I want one.
So, all right, Ethan. Well, we're going to wrap it up, but we have one last question that we ask all our guests. So, and I'll tidy this one up. If money was no object, laws were no object, what animal would you want to keep?
Oh, let's see. I mean, I probably would say it's the one I keep Brachydactylus leechianus, which I'd wanted since I was a little kid. I have a pair of those, the new Ami pair. I guess that would be my choice. My second choice would be actual mud puppies. We've been talking about axolotls. Mud puppy is another Neotenic salamander. Right. They're not legal to keep in my state, so I don't keep those. So.
Great.
Very cool.
Well, at least you get to keep some of your childhood dream animals. Yeah. So.
Yeah. No kidding. Well, Ethan, right. Once again, I appreciate you being on the show. Thank you for your time, and thank you for the Black Mud Puppy. It's an awesome comic.
Thank you.
You guys definitely got to check it out, blackmudpuppy.com. Ethan Kochak, thank you once again.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Awesome.
Thanks, Ethan, and everybody out there viewing us. Check us out next week, next Thursday, 9 p.m. View us on Google+. You can also watch us on YouTube. Become a fan of our Facebook fan page, www.facebook.com/reptileLivingRoom. And I think that's about it for this week, and we'll catch you next week.